Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Any day now, Joe Biden will announce his pick for the actual Democratic nominee. That's the person who will run the government if Biden wins in November. We've been telling you about this process for weeks now. We've taken a closer look at three potential candidates. All of them are said to be on Joe Biden's shortlist for the job. They are Stacey Abrams, Karen Bass, and Kamala Harris. Now, in a normal year, no mainstream candidate would consider any of these people. All of them would be disqualified without debate. Karen Bass is a lunatic Fidel Castro acolyte who praised Scientology and once belonged to an armed revolutionary group. She's out. Stacey Abrams is so delusional she thinks she's the governor of Georgia. And by the way, she's essentially unemployed. In one of her last regular jobs, she wrote bad porn novels. For real. Kamala Harris, meanwhile, is so transparently transactional that even Democratic primary voters, who have a strong stomach, found her repulsive. Pretty much no one who knows Kamala Harris likes her. So overall, it's not a blue ribbon group. But according to Joe Biden, this isn't a normal year and the normal standards don't apply. For what could very well be the most important job on earth, Biden has decided to hire exclusively on the basis of qualities that are both immutable and completely irrelevant, race and gender. And that's it. But wait a second, you ask. Isn't that insulting? Isn't it wrong? Isn't it probably illegal? Yes, it is all three of those things. But no one's pushing back against it, so Biden is doing it. The problem is that all three of the people we just told you about might wind up in the end hurting the Biden campaign. They're just too unimpressive to run. Biden's handlers seem to have figured this out. Above all, the Democratic Party wants to win this year. They're not in it for sentimental reasons or for love of Joe Biden. They're in it for the power, and they want it badly. So today, the odds seem to shift dramatically in another direction, away from Karen Bass and Kamala Harris and Stacey Abrams, and towards someone you have seen before. That would be former National Security Advisor Susan Rice. As of right now, Susan Rice appears to be in the lead for the VP slot. Now, that's an interesting development. Say what you will about Susan Rice, and we're about to, but she is not a buffoon. Susan Rice is smart. She is hard-eyed. She is experienced. Susan Rice knows exactly what she wants, and she understands the system well enough to get it. She is a threat. So what exactly does Susan Rice believe? Well, in a sentence, Susan Rice believes what everyone else in permanent Washington believes, because above all, Rice is a product of D.C. She grew up there. So to our political class, Rice is the opposite of an outsider. She's the home team. Like almost everyone in Washington, she is above all a fervent neocon. As a member of Obama's cabinet, she pushed for the counterproductive killing of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. She has never apologized for that. She should. Then in the Clinton administration, she supported the bombing of a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. And needless to say, it goes without saying, really, Rice led the chorus of liars who claimed that Donald Trump was secretly a Russian agent.
He's taken a series of steps that, had Vladimir Putin dictated them, he couldn't have mirrored more effectively. What his motivations are, I think, is a legitimate question, one that I trust that the special counsel is investigating. But the policies that this president has pursued globally have served Vladimir Putin's interest in dividing the West, undermining democracy.
Does that mean you think it's an open question whether or not he's compromised by Russia?
George, I don't know what his motivations are. I think that's a legitimate question.
Now, to be perfectly clear, this is not someone who's just throwing words out. This is someone who's highly sophisticated in the nuances of foreign policy. In other words, Susan Rice knew perfectly well when she said what you just heard that it was false. She knew that much of this administration's actual agenda, from arming Ukraine to expanding domestic energy production here in the U.S., hurt Russian interests badly. And yet Rice didn't acknowledge that. Instead, she smeared the president as a Kremlin pawn. In fact, what Rice objected to were Trump's foreign policy views, views which, not incidentally, the majority of Americans say they support. It turns out that only people in Washington, like Susan Rice, want more pointless wars around the world because they're the ones who profit from them. Most normal people don't want more pointless wars because they're the ones who fight them. But Rice doesn't care either way. Watch her reaction to the administration's plan to remove troops from Syria.
I woke up this morning to hear that news, and as I do, it seems like 6 days a week, I just put my head in my hands. This is bat crazy.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. It's almost unbelievable. It's crazy to bring troops home from a country that we have no strategic interest in, who are there to fulfill a mission we can't articulate. That's crazy. But that's a consensus view in Washington. When the U.S. consulate in Benghazi was destroyed in 2012, Rice herself said something that was actually crazy. She blamed that attack on an online video. Once again, Rice knew when she said it, it wasn't true, but she said it anyway.
What sparked the recent violence was the airing on the internet of a very hateful, very offensive in Benghazi as a reaction to what had transpired some hours earlier in Cairo, where, of course, as you know, there was a violent protest outside of our embassy sparked by this hateful video. What happened in Benghazi was, in fact, initially a spontaneous reaction to what had just transpired hours before in Cairo. What happened this week in Cairo, in Benghazi, and many other parts of the region,
Tunisia, Khartoum,
was a result, a direct result of a heinous and offensive video.
It was heinous. It was offensive. It was hateful. This video, which dared criticize radical Islam. People saw this. They were so offended that they justifiably rose up and started shooting Americans. That was the implication of what she said. But Rice knew that was a lie when she said it. She knew the attack in Benghazi was not spontaneous. It wasn't based in outrage, and it was not staged in response to that or any other video. She knew that because her own intelligence reports made it perfectly clear. But it was an election year, and Rice said what she had to say. By the way, the man who actually made the video, the heinous, offensive, hateful video, was a Coptic Christian. He was arrested after Rice's appearances on television. He was jailed without bail. It was a purely political prosecution of the kind the rest of us reassure ourselves doesn't happen in this country, but unfortunately sometimes does. Whatever happened to that man? No one checked. We did today. 4 years later, he was living in a homeless shelter. His life was completely destroyed. Susan Rice has never apologized to him, doesn't appear to have even looked back. That's a moral crime. Has Rice committed legal crimes? U.S. Attorney John Durham is looking into that right now, and of course we'll bring you the results of that investigation when they finally appear. We're still waiting. We do know, though, that Rice monitored conversations that Trump advisors were having with foreign officials and then requested the unmasking of those advisors. Rice was asked about this in a television interview, and here's how she responded.
During the transition, after President Trump had been elected, that he and the people around him may have been caught up in surveillance of foreign individuals and that their identities may have been disclosed. Do you know anything about this?
I know nothing about this. I was surprised to see reports from Chairman Yunus on that count today.
Here's just a pro tip in case you're watching these interviews at home. When a political figure laughs in a way that suggests not real mirth but nervousness in the middle of an answer, that's a tell. That means they're lying. And in fact, she was lying in that interview. We know that for certain. The other thing we know for certain is that Susan Rice will say whatever she thinks it takes. So it's not surprising that Joe Biden is considering her tonight. And once again, he definitely is.
News surrounding a massive deadly explosion at a Beirut, Lebanon. Wait till you see this tape in full. That's straight ahead. Plus, we have the very latest details from today's heated Antifa hearing on Capitol Hill. Senator Ted Cruz is with us. Also, Condoleezza Rice slamming the thought police on the radical left. We'll explain that. Also, we start tonight with a developing story out of, yes, Joe Biden's basement bunker. Tonight, there are currently three presidential debates in the works. Joe's biggest fans and the media mob are now begging him not to show. I have sources telling me tonight that his team is saying, well, can we bring notes? Now, they clearly believe that Joe Biden is too weak and too feeble. They're worried that he will be destroyed by President Trump and fake conspiracy news theorists. CNN's own Humpty Dumpty tweeting that this story is far removed from reality. Oh, okay, there's no violence in Seattle or Portland, and it's just a summer of love and festive atmosphere. I guess they forgot about their own network's coverage, or maybe They're just psychotic liars over there. One top political analyst, fake news, CNN, actually pleading with Biden, please don't debate Donald Trump. Here's a New York Times op-ed entitled, Let's Scrap the Presidential Debates. Here's another one from the Boston Herald. Biden better walk back any offers to debate President Trump. A report from Newsweek claiming that Joe Biden's own supporters were urging him, don't debate the president. Now, normally a candidate challenging an incumbent pushes for as many debates as possible, not Joe Biden and not his supporters. They want him to stay hiding and for good reason. His most recent debate performances were, well, frankly, painful to watch. So tonight we're going to take you on what is really a cringeworthy trip down memory lane because you are the ultimate voter. You will be the jury and the ultimate deciders in just 91 days as we show you the very worst moments. Now, we start with this bizarre soundbite of Biden talking about, well, clipping coupons in the stock market. Okay, let's watch.
Why in God's name should someone who's clipping coupons in the stock market make, in fact, pay a lower tax rate than someone who, in fact, is, like I said, a school teacher and a firefighter?
Does Joe even know what he's trying to say? Another odd moment, Biden encouraging all children to listen to a record player at night. When did we last had a record player? Take a look.
Play the radio. Make sure the television, make sure you have the record player on at night. The phone, make sure the kids hear words.
And the confusion doesn't stop there. One debate, he actually forgot that Senator Kamala Harris even existed. Take a look.
I have more people supporting me in the black community that have announced for me because they know me. They know who I am. Three former chairs of the Black Caucus, the only African-American woman that ever been elected to the United States Senate, a whole range of people.
No,
my point
that's
is,
not true. The other
that's
one
not
is
true.
Here.
I said the first African-American elected. First African-American.
What day is it? Super Thursday. What state am I in? No hard feelings, Senator. Joe can't even seem to remember his own web address or how text messaging works. Take a look.
We have never been unable to overcome whatever the problem was. If you agree with me, go to Joe 30330 and help me in this fight.
By the way, for the record, that meant nothing. There was no Joe 30330 anything. Now, confusion is not Biden's only issue. Well, his fits of rage, they're also concerning. For example, here's a clip of Joe berating his potential running mate, Elizabeth Warren. Let's take a look at that.
Let me, she referenced me. Okay. I agreed with the great job she did, and I went on the floor and got you votes. I got votes for that bill. I convinced people to vote for it. So let's get those things straight, too.
Now, if you thought that was bad, just listen to his plan to eradicate domestic violence.
No man has a right to raise a hand to a woman in anger other than in self-defense, and that's rarely ever occurs. And so we have to just change the culture, period, and keep punching at it and punching at it and punching at it. It will be a big no, I really mean it. It's a gigantic issue.
All right, no one knows what's going to come out of Joe's mouth. I don't even think Joe himself knows. But what scares Democrats the most are Joe Biden's, well, let's say weird, strange, bizarre stories. Here's one example. Take a look.
And by the way, you know, I sit on the stand and it get hot. I got hairy legs that turn blonde in the sun. And the kids used to come up and reach in the pool and rub my leg down so it was straight and then watch the hair come back up again. They'd look at it. So I learned about roaches. I learned about kids jumping on my lap. And I've loved kids jumping on my lap.
Hairy legs turn blonde and kids like to rub it. What? Leg, hair, children, roaches, what? Ask yourself, this is a fair question. Does he have the mental alertness? Is this man fit to serve as the commander-in-chief? Does he have the strength and stamina? It's the most demanding job in the world, and it's obvious, frankly, to everyone that Joe Biden is a massive liability to himself, to the Democratic Party, and more importantly, to this country as a whole. And some on the left, the radical left, They see it as an opportunity. Why? Because he's like the dumb, useful idiot that they will use to, quote, transform this country and the economies, he said. That's why this is by far the most consequential election in our lifetime. I have a new book out today. Thank you. You made it number one on Amazon.com of the entire country. Live Free or Die, America and the World on the Brink. It's out today, Hannity.com, Amazon.com. But in this book, the reason I wrote this first in 10 years, I cover in detail what makes this country so special. And as Reagan said and warned us, freedom is but one generation away from extinction. Make no mistake, if the radical left take over this country, if they implement their stated socialist policies, you can pretty much kiss freedom goodbye, and none of those promises will ever be fulfilled. How's Social Security? How's Medicare? Let's see. How's that Obamacare keep your plan and your doctor and save money? How's that working out?
Ms. Yates, when did you first become aware that the Obama administration was surveilling the Donald Trump campaign?
The Obama administration was not surveilling the Donald Trump campaign.
So a FISA application is not surveillance?
The FISA application was for Carter Page, who was a former member of the Trump campaign at that point.
So your testimony is that the investigation in Carter Page had nothing to do with the Donald Trump campaign?
No, I suggest you ask me if we were surveilling the campaign.
You don't get it both ways. Is it the campaign or not?
Senator, I'm trying to give you what is the accurate information here. Carter Page was a former member of the Trump campaign at the time that the FISA was initiated.
And what was the reason for the FISA on Carter Page?
There were a number of reasons. First, we had gotten the information that I was trying to point out here, that the Russians had made the overture that they wanted to be able to assist the Trump campaign.
Now, hold on, you said it had nothing to do with the Trump campaign.
I said that he was not a member of the Trump campaign at the time that we initiated the FISA.
Ms. Yates, in your time at the Department of Justice, are you aware of any other political opponents of President Obama that were being surveilled?
Again, Senator, if you're talking about the court-authorized surveillance of Carter Page.
I'm asking, are you aware of any surveillance of any other political opponents, any other candidates for president in 2016? There were a whole bunch of them, including the chairman and myself. Were either of us
been a waste
surveilled,
of time
yes or no?
The answer to that is no, and I also think that there was also no information that the Russians were working to aid another candidate other than Donald Trump.
Okay, so your testimony is no other candidate in 2016 was being surveilled other than Carter Page and the Trump campaign. Is that right?
Other than Carter Page.
Okay. When did you first become aware of the investigation and the surveillance on Carter Page?
When the FISA application was presented to me in October, I knew that the NSD lawyers were working on it for some period of time prior to that with the FBI. So it would have been in the October range.
I don't mean to interrupt, but wasn't Papadopoulos also being taped?
Ms. Yates, the chairman asked a good question.
My understanding, I was not aware at the time, but my understanding is that Papadopoulos, that there was a recorded conversation between Papadopoulos and a source, not wiretap surveillance. But
no,
there
but
was
the
a
government orchestrated this, right?
That's what I know now. Didn't know that at the time. Yes.
So we know that the government orchestrated a recording of conversations with Papadopoulos and got a warrant against Carter Page. That seems to me surveillance.
So when they came to you asking to surveil members of the Trump campaign because of conduct they allegedly did while members of the Trump campaign, what due diligence did you do? Did you press back at all? You already told Senator Kennedy you just trusted the FBI. You didn't ask about their sources. What due diligence did you do before signing off on what we now have significant reason to believe was a profound politicization of law enforcement and intelligence?
Senator, there was a tremendous amount of process back and forth between the lawyers in the National Security Division and the FBI.
Okay, I asked what you did, not other lawyers. What due diligence did you do? You were the one signing off on it.
And with respect to whether the facts were accurate in this instance.
So did you inquire whether it was opposition research funded by the DNC or Hillary Clinton?
Yes, I did have a discussion about that.
And with whom?
With a lawyer in my office.
Would that have been Bruce Orr?
No, Bruce Orr was not working on this.
So, but his wife was working for Fusion GPS, being paid by Hillary Clinton and the DNC, and he certainly was actively involved in this investigation. Did you know that? Did anyone inquire about that?
No, I had no idea of that. Learned that from the Inspector General's investigation. And Bruce Orr was not working with us on any of these FISA applications.
You said earlier that nobody was trying to get President Trump. Have you read the Horowitz Inspector General report?
I have. And Inspector General Horowitz found that he did not find any evidence of bias or political motive.
Ms. Yates, with all due respect, Inspector General Horowitz found 17 material misstatements in those FISA applications, including a lawyer from the FBI who fraudulently altered a document and submitted it, and in fact took the question, was Carter Page an asset from the FBI for the CIA? The CIA said yes. He altered the document and changed it to a no. You're telling me that nobody wanted to get Trump? How about that lawyer that fraudulently altered a document to get this surveillance?
I'm telling you that Inspector General Horowitz did over 170 interviews and reviewed more than a million documents, and he's in a better position than I am to be able to make a conclusion about whether there was evidence of a political motive or bias.
Ms. Yates, let me just make a final observation. You mentioned in your testimony the principled career men and women at the Department of Justice and the FBI, and you're right. There are tremendous principles whose integrity has been called into question by the profound politicization of the leadership of the department and of the Bureau. And to sign off on turning the FBI and the CIA into a tool of opposition research and attacking your political opponents, and to go all the way to the Oval Office as you did on January 5th with President Obama and Joe Biden, going after their political opponents, it's wrong, and it has done immeasurable damage to the professionals and the men and women of integrity at the Department of Justice and at the Bureau.
Washington Field Office, James Dawson, who you'll be hearing from in a minute. We have what I believe is a significant law enforcement announcement to make today. Starting in the wee hours of this morning, the brave men and women in law enforcement effectuated the arrest of 10 MS-13 members or close associates thereof who stand charged with the sex trafficking of a minor under the age of 14. One of the alleged gang members, Carlos Villatoro, an 11th defendant, is charged with violent crimes in aid of racketeering. Let me make clear, these individuals are charged with heinous offenses, but just like any other defendant, they're entitled to and deserve the presumption of innocence until they're proven otherwise. Combating human trafficking has been a priority for this office for over a decade. Specifically targeting gang-controlled sex trafficking is something that I dedicated almost 3 years of my life to as an assistant United States attorney in this district and in the courtrooms just behind us. In that vein, I want to speak with you today to ensure that our community has continued awareness about what is happening within our district and to make clear that we will not stop investigating or combating this scourge of modern-day slavery. Unfortunately, the work I started almost a decade ago with the first prosecution of an MS-13 member for sex trafficking continues today. Here are some of the heart-wrenching facts as alleged in the criminal complaint. And again, I want to be clear, these are allegations at this point. One of the victims in this case was 13 years old. Let me repeat that, 13 years old, when she was sexually trafficked to paying pedophiles, sexually assaulted repeatedly by gang members, and beaten with a metal bat on multiple occasions. Further, due to the comprehensive nature of this investigation, we have communications between gang members about how they were going to treat this 13-year-old victim. This text message dialogue can be found in the unsealed complaint. And I quote, "Tell him to come. I'm dying to hit that daughter of a B-I-T-C-H with a baseball bat. A homeboy in El Salvador wants to watch what happens." In another exchange about the minor victim, "Who is getting the joint, coca, the beer? I will get the little whores." As alleged in this criminal complaint, this 13-year-old was plied with marijuana, alcohol, and even cocaine. She was trafficked in apartments as well as wooded areas behind apartment complexes. This took place in Virginia and Maryland.
So I got this letter from a man named Robert who reads my daily newsletter. And in it, he raised some interesting points about President Trump and the Republicans. Now, here's his letter. "Governor Huckabee, with all due respect, look who's talking. President Trump didn't even have the decency to attend the funeral of the late, great John Lewis. Of course, this is typical of him. And yes, Trump is a vicious racist. And you have to bring up the irrelevant fact that Bull Connor was a Democrat? Such racist bigots are no longer found in this party. However, the racism of the Republicans is now much more subtle. Republican social and economic policies have done nothing but grievous harm to blacks and other minorities in America. They've done it for decades. For example, making it extremely difficult for them to vote and suppressing so many of their votes by failing to count them. Constantly eviscerating and abolishing essential government programs to help the poor. GOP refusal to raise the minimum wage, thus keeping millions of Americans helplessly mired in poverty. Refusing to make health care, college, food, and housing affordable, and so on. And on top of this, GOP politicians have the sheer unmitigated gall to accuse the struggling poor of being lazy bums who want to sponge off the government, while it allegedly takes hard-earned money from honest Americans who do work. John Wilson spent his life fighting these destructive GOP policies. Trump is only making them worse." That's the end of the letter. Well, I got to tell you, I kind of thank Robert for listing so many false Democratic political narratives in one post. During an election year, we're going to be hearing all of this repeated ad nauseum. So it's helpful to be able to respond to all of his points at one time. First, Robert, I don't know who John Wilson is, but I'm going to assume that's just a typo and you meant John Lewis. Also, I can only imagine the media meltdown if Trump had attended that funeral. He would have been accused of hijacking the funeral to score cheap political points, like President Obama actually did. His choice was between "how dare he show up there" and "how dare he not show up there." All things considered, I think President Trump made probably the most respectful choice. As to your other points, let me go through them and reply to them one by one. First, you say, yes, despite what he and his defenders say, Trump is a vicious racist, end quote. Now, you said this without offering a single scrap of proof. I want you to know I consider racism to be a grievous sin, and racist is one of the worst things you can call someone. That word should never be thrown around lightly, which unfortunately is. Happening today. The Trump narrative is based on viciously fake news stories, like claiming that he called all Mexicans rapists and murderers, even though he was talking about MS-13 gang members, or that there were fine people on the side of white supremacists, when he was actually referring to some people who oppose simply removing Confederate statues. He actually said that neo-Nazis and white nationalists should be condemned totally. You never mentioned that. A tabloid reporter whose job was to cover President Trump before he entered politics said that while he was desperate for any dirt, he never heard any claims of Trump being a racist until the day that Donald Trump announced he was running for president as a Republican. And then he suddenly became the biggest racist ever. He revealed that he did get a number of stories about Donald Trump performing secret acts of generosity, like paying the bills of unfortunate people that he read about in the media. But the tabloids weren't interested in positive stories, and Trump didn't publicize them. Pre-political Trump won numerous awards for his support of Black, Jewish, and youth organizations. Even the Reverend Jesse Jackson praised Donald Trump for his support of the Rainbow Coalition's project to help minority businesses. Jesse Jackson called Trump, quote, a friend who embraced the underserved communities, end quote. Number two, you also say, and you have to bring up the irrelevant fact that Bull Connor, the Birmingham, Alabama sheriff in the 60s, was a Democrat. Well, Robert, I mentioned that Bull Connor was a Democrat, and by the way, not just a Democrat, but a delegate to the 1948 convention, where he led a walkout of the Alabama delegation over a proposed civil rights plank, because the Democrats would like modern Americans never to know that. It's a cynical attempt to rewrite history so that the misled can be manipulated for political purposes. We don't allow that around these parts. And besides, if American citizens are to believe that America is evil because bad things happened in it, well, then Democrats should believe their party is racist because racist things happened in it. Which leads me to your third statement. Number three, you said, such racist bigots are no longer found in the Democrat Party, end quote. The modern Democrat Party is all about dividing and judging people by skin color, which is a complete repudiation of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. And I don't just mean reverse racism against white people. Watch some of the videos online of those white, peaceful protesters supported by Democrat mayors screaming disgusting racist insults into the faces of Black police officers, and for that matter, any Black people who dare to express different opinions, sometimes even physically assaulting them. Number four, Robert, you said Republican social and economic policies have done nothing but grievous harm to Blacks and other minorities in America for decades. Robert, this is a really odd one. I mean, cities where the Black and minority communities are suffering from crime, gangs, filthy and decaying neighborhoods, and terrible schools, like Chicago, Detroit, and Baltimore, have been run entirely by Democrats for decades. Chicago hasn't had a Republican mayor since 1931. In Minneapolis, where George Floyd's death kicked off all these protests, both the city and the state are solidly Democrat. There's not even a single Republican on the city council. Number five, you say, quote, making it extremely difficult for them to vote and suppressing so many of their votes by failing to count them, end quote. Again, an assertion, but no proof. Republicans believe in voter ID because we want all the elections to be honest and trustworthy. I'm all for everyone voting who is legally eligible, but every fake vote cast cancels out a legitimate vote, denying that voter his or her most fundamental right to have a say in determining our government. As for voter suppression, boy, that's a convenient excuse for barring even the most rudimentary efforts to ensure a clean election, from voter IDs to purging dead people off the voting rolls. Now, the queen of that narrative is Stacey Abrams, who somehow claimed for the past 2 years that she is the rightful governor of Georgia, deprived of office by voter suppression. Yet 1.3 million more Georgians voted in that midterm election than in the previous midterm election. Robert, if Republicans suppress the vote, they sure did a lousy job of it. Number six, constantly eviscerating and abolishing essential government programs to help the poor is what you said. And I would ask, like what? As Ronald Reagan once said, there's nothing so permanent as a temporary government program. Democrats love to accuse Republicans of slashing one program or another. Social Security is a prime example. Yet spending always, I say always, increases. Merely suggesting a reduction in the rate of increase gets you accused of slashing the budget, even if it would still mean more money than the rate of inflation. Now, if you mean things like requiring able-bodied people with no family obligations to work in exchange for welfare, then probably a lot of us would plead guilty. The government shouldn't make it easier and more lucrative to be on the dole than to work when a job is available. Number 7. You said GOP refusal to raise the minimum wage, thus keeping millions of Americans helplessly mired in poverty, end quote. Well, as someone who grew up poor, if I really thought that simply raising the minimum wage would end poverty, I'd be on the front lines demanding it. But it's the sort of simplistic idea that comes from people who've never run a business, who maybe just studied economics from some liberal professor. Simply ordering businesses that pay the minimum wage to raise or even double it violates the most basic law of supply and demand, forcibly pricing labor at more than it's worth. Many of these employers are small businesses. They've got tiny profit margins whose owners might even put in 60, 70 hours or more a week, and who, quite frankly, make less than minimum wage themselves. If they raise prices enough to cover the new labor costs, they drive away their customers. Then their only choice is to cut staff, and those who do keep their jobs soon discover the raise doesn't help because prices go up everywhere in order to cover the new labor cost. Many businesses, they don't survive at all. Here's an example. After San Francisco voted to double the minimum wage, there was a story about a longtime liberal bookstore that went out of business. The patrons of that store were shocked to learn that there was some connection between their vote to raise the minimum wage and losing their favorite hangout. Liberal Seattle restaurant critics were baffled at why all the little bistros they loved were closing down. And in New York, the place where AOC used to bartend went out of business because of the minimum wage hike that she advocated, and all her former co-workers ended up losing their jobs. I think that's too bad for a lot of reasons. I was kind of hoping she'd return to work there real soon. Number 8, refusing to make healthcare, college, food, and housing affordable, you say. Well, Robert, the reason, and really the major reason, that most of these things cost what they do is because of government subsidies, mandates, taxes, regulations, and interference in the marketplace, which are all Democrat hallmarks. Do you have any idea how much complying with Medicare costs doctors and how much time they spend dealing with paperwork instead of seeing patients? Before all the government insurance and Medicare involvement, frankly, doctors never charged $50 for a Band-Aid. Try comparing the prices of food, housing, or fuel in California or New York to those in Texas or Florida. Like it or not, liberal policies make everything more expensive. And then the politicians raise taxes to help people pay for the things that they made more expensive that will now get even more expensive because of the high taxes, and on it goes in a never-ending vicious cycle. Number 9. You said, quote, GOP politicians have the sheer unmitigated gall to accuse the struggling poor of being lazy bums who want to sponge off the government, end quote. Well, I don't do that. And frankly, I don't know anyone who does. But if anyone actually does, they're wrong. Clearly, they're wrong. I've been the struggling poor, and I know better. I suggest you broaden your news sources. I do believe, though, that because I actually do read and watch liberal news sources from time to time, as painful as that sometimes can be, I find that this sort of canard is repeated because the left hopes to fool the poor into voting against policies that would, frankly, lift them out of poverty in favor of policies that will keep them struggling, and of course that means dependent on government. Well, I might as well make it a hat trick and finish this off with a third Reagan quote. Republicans don't measure compassion by how many people are getting a government handout. We measure it by how many people no longer need a government handout. Again, Robert, I want to thank you so much for rattling off so many of the kooky Democratic talking points in one place. You've made a significant contribution to the future of our country, and you certainly made my job very easy and much more efficient. Well, if you have enjoyed this video, I hope you'll consider subscribing and clicking the notification bell so that you'll know whenever we upload new videos. And leave a like and share this video all over the interwebs. Of course, I know that you know someone who needs to see it. Sure you do. And if you want more of my news, analysis, and commentary, hey, it's about time you sign up for my newsletter at MikeHuckabee.com. It's completely free.
evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. For most Americans who don't live in New York City, New York is a lot like your half-drunk, ne'er-do-well uncle. Flashy, loud, always bragging about himself, though somewhat less impressive than he claims to be. You love your uncle, you just don't want to know too much about his personal life. There's no question it is messy and weird. You suspect he owes a lot of people money. You know he eats with his mouth open. Still, he's your uncle. Your lives are intertwined. If he gets some incurable disease and dies, you'll be sad about it. And New York is the same way. Even if you dislike New York too much to visit, you should care what happens there because you're an American, and New York is by far this country's biggest city. New York has more than twice as many people as second place Los Angeles. It's physically tiny. The entire island of Manhattan is smaller than Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. But New York produces close to 10% of our total GDP in this country. So what happens to New York matters to the rest of us, like the place or not. Until recently, New York seemed to be thriving. Officials there had succeeded in doing the single most important thing that civic leaders anywhere can do. They made their city safe for normal people to live there. New York was one of the least dangerous metro areas in the world. They bragged about it. There's no mystery how they did it. The city hired tens of thousands of cops. They threw criminals and antisocial destroyers in jail, and they left them there. And it worked. New York improved dramatically. People with choices, people could live anywhere, wanted to live there. And then, in a short space of time, Mayor Bill de Blasio arrived, and he set about reversing the formula. On the basis of no evidence, de Blasio attacked the police department of New York as racist. He then cut $1 billion from the NYPD budget. Demoralized cops stopped making arrests, and almost immediately, crime and violence in the city exploded. In a single Manhattan neighborhood, the Upper East Side, robberies have jumped by 286% this year. Things fell apart. New Yorkers who could leave the city did leave, the entire tax base fleeing to Florida. Bill de Blasio watched these entirely predictable things happen, glassy-eyed, breathing through his mouth, probably too high to process it all. In the end, de Blasio concluded that none of it was his fault. New Yorkers, he decided, have had it too easy. What they need is more suffering. So today, de Blasio announced that he plans to encircle the entire city with military-style checkpoints, not to stop violent criminals, but to prevent people from visiting from other places. There was no public discussion of this ahead of time. There was no debate. De Blasio just decreed it.
So starting today, we're going to do something new in New York City. We will have checkpoints at key entry points to the city. Travelers coming in from those states will be given information about the quarantine. They'll be reminded that it is required, not optional. They'll be reminded that failure to quarantine is a violation of state law, and it comes with serious penalties. In fact, under certain circumstances, the fines can be as high as $10,000.
Got that? It doesn't make any sense at all. He didn't bother to explain why they're doing it. There's no science behind it. But the one thing that you know for sure is it's your fault. Not his, yours. Your failures are a severe violation of the law, says Bill de Blasio. You'll be punished if you disobey. You are bad. So travelers to New York City are about to learn a very important lesson. It's a lesson that residents of nursing homes in New York, the ones who survived, have already learned. And it's this. The people who make the worst decisions, the decisions that kill people, never face consequences for those decisions. Only you do. So shut up and show us your papers, peasant. Now, one of the many ironies here, and there are many, is that back in March of this year, New York threatened to sue the state of Rhode Island for trying to set up the very same kind of checkpoints. At the time, Andrew Cuomo, he's the governor of New York, called checkpoints like this, quote, unconstitutional and reactionary. So what changed? Well, who knows? Don't waste your time looking for consistency. Bureaucracies don't have to be consistent because they're in charge. They can do whatever they want. They don't have to explain why. So at the very moment that they've decided to treat taxpayers of New York like refugees in a war zone with checkpoints, leaders in New York seem to be doing all they can to make life easier for thugs with guns. Back in May, for example, the city of New York released a gang member from custody without bail. He'd been charged with attempted murder, but they just let him go. Here are pictures of the alleged crime. Imagine letting that guy, the guy with the gun, shooting someone on the sidewalk, just walk out free. Why would you do that? You would have to hate the people who live in your city in order to do that. Prosecutors say that that suspect, a man called Darius Sutton, went on, after New York let him out, to commit three more shootings, because of course he did. Bill de Blasio doesn't want to talk about any of that. He doesn't want you to talk about it either. The thing about social justice is you're just going to have to ignore the details. Instead, city officials would like you to stay terrified of the coronavirus, because more anxiety about invisible viruses will take your mind off the shootings and the decay. So in a few days, New York will begin following and harassing travelers. They're going to text and call you if you plan to travel. And if you don't respond, city workers may come to your home in person. Listen to a man called Ted Long explain the plan. He runs something called the Test and Trace Corps in New York.
Tomorrow, we're going to be deploying teams to Penn Station to stop travelers to ensure that they've completed the travel form. We've made more than 86,000 phone calls to travelers coming into New York City from the designated high-risk states, and we've sent more than 20,000 text messages to date. And if we can't get through to you on the phone, we've deployed teams that are now knocking on your door to check in with you.
Oh, so Ted Long is going to deploy teams to Penn Station. Have you been to Penn Station recently? It's a homeless shelter, the whole thing. Oh, there's a guy with his trousers down, relieving himself in the corner. Hey, they're dealing crack right there. Oh, they're smoking it over here. Go to Penn Station and ask yourself, is this real? Is this America? But Ted Long is going to deploy teams to hassle people who are traveling to New York to help the city stay afloat. Right. Keep in mind the vehement little lecture you just heard about public health comes from the same people who forced coronavirus patients into nursing homes and killed many by doing it. These are the same leaders who gave violent rioters control of the city's streets, but suddenly they are very concerned about your health. Right. What they're actually concerned about, as always, is maintaining political control. And, of course, money. Money is suddenly a pressing concern for them. And the main problem is, and they're going to fix this if they can, that under our current system, it's pretty difficult to force people to remain in crumbling cities because, for now, we still have freedom of movement. Rich people are running away from New York. They have more freedom of movement than anyone because they can afford to go wherever they want. And they see what's coming. It's pretty obvious. They plan to be somewhere else when it arrives. And this raises the question of who is going to pay for all of these failed and poisonous social experiments, the ones that turned a train station into a homeless shelter in Midtown. Andrew Cuomo is smart enough to be worried about this. He is now begging millionaires to come back to the hellhole he helped create.
We used to be worried millionaires' tax people might leave. No. The burden shifted. We're trying to get people to come back. I literally talk to people all day long who are now in the Hamptons house, who also lived here, or in their Hudson Valley house, or in their Connecticut weekend house. And I say, you got to come back. When are you coming back? We'll go to dinner. I'll buy you a drink. Come over. I'll cook. They're not coming back right now.
It's pathetic. Oh, they're in their Hamptons house. Come back to New York. It's great. I'll meet you at Penn Station. We'll get a burger and some hepatitis. Yeah. So it turns out rich people may be evil, but in the end, you need a few of them to pay for everything. Otherwise, you have no political power. That's an obvious truth that Cuomo is, in effect, saying. The city's pothead mayor, by contrast, cannot admit that out loud. It's entirely possible he doesn't even understand the principle. But Bill de Blasio does know that his disintegrating city will need money from somewhere, and soon. So he's thinking that the rest of America should pay for his disaster.
If we do not get federal support soon, and I'm very worried about these stimulus talks in Washington, Wolf, because they seem to be going nowhere fast, my challenge is, where am I going to have the people to do this work? I may have to do as many as layoffs of 22,000 city employees from every department by October 1st if I don't get federal help.
So consult your Bill de Blasio cheat sheet. Look it up. We keep ours right here. And if you do, you will see that it was less than a month ago that this same man, Bill de Blasio, threatened to sue the federal government if they helped too much, if they deployed federal law enforcement officers to his city. Now he's whining that the feds are not doing enough. Shameless? Obviously, of course it is. And yet, to be fair, it's possible that de Blasio has no short-term memory left and simply doesn't remember what he said last month.
Last night, we tore the lid off a series of oft-repeated liberal lies about President Trump's handling of the coronavirus. The pandemic's fallout, though, of course, extremely tragic, could have been far worse had he not shut down travel early and reopened the economy when he did. Hospital systems in a few states were stretched, but not overwhelmed. But given the Democrats' constant wailing about what Trump supposedly got wrong, we decided tonight to sketch out what the situation would have looked like had Joe Biden and the Democrats been in charge instead. First, Biden would not have banned travel from China. There's no way he would have done that. 2 months after Trump did just that, Biden was still worrying about hurting China's feelings.
Being overly dismissive or spreading misinformation is only going to hurt us and further advantage the spread of the disease. But neither should we panic or fall back on xenophobia. Labeling COVID-19 a foreign virus does not displace accountability for the misjudgments that have been taken thus far by the Trump administration.
I was worried about xenophobia, not the virus. Not only would Biden not have banned travel from China, though, he would have effectively rewarded the CCP for unleashing this plague by allowing them to continue to steal our trade secrets and take our jobs. It's clear under Biden, there'd be no tariffs and thus no Chinese concessions.
Some have said a Trump stance is a good one to counter China's influence. Would you keep the tariffs?
No. Hey, look, who said Trump's idea is a good one?
No, he would get rid of the tariffs day one. A Biden presidency is a dream scenario for the CCP. And given that the WHO has been pimping for China for years, how would dealing with them, he also suggested, that help? And you know Biden wouldn't have banned travel from Europe either. Even Fauci admitted doing so saved lives. But under Biden, as under Obama, Europe's feelings on a travel ban would have been more important than what was good for Americans. Heaven forbid, can't offend the French.
Banning all travel from Europe or any other part of the world may slow it, but as we've seen, it will not stop it. And travel restrictions based on favoritism and politics rather than risk will be counterproductive.
I mean, you can't make this up. And under Biden, illegals, they'd keep pouring in. And of course, forget ramped up border enforcement under Biden at all. Even European countries like Germany locked down their borders for 3 months. But Joe would never even consider a crackdown on illegal border crossings, even during a pandemic. He'd open the ICE facilities, he'd release all detainees, and then maybe ask questions later. After all, what would Jorge Ramos say?
Trump campaigned on build that wall. Are you willing to tear that wall down?
No, there will not be another foot of wall constructed in my administration.
No, of course, the border fence and the walls, they're meant to force foreigners to formal points of entry, where we at least can do some minimal screening for illnesses. But Biden will always choose open borders ahead of the health, safety, and economic well-being of Americans. Number three, Biden would keep you locked down until at least 2021. And while he's letting millions of illegal aliens flood the labor markets during a recession and bring in more cases of COVID, he'd make sure you're still locked down in your home and your kids were out of school. His allies in politics and the press who are messaging Biden's plans, they've spilled the beans.
If you're not going to stay home and you're not going to wear masks in public, we have to enforce, and we will.
This could have been a very different summer if we'd had a better lockdown, a longer lockdown.
Any concern that you've gone too far in any way with the stay-at-home restrictions?
No.
And Biden hinted at this himself just last week.
From the beginning, in my view, the president has had given us a false choice. He said that we have to get back to work. and also deal with COVID. You can't get this country going again unless you get COVID under control.
You know what that means. And number four, Biden's lockdowns would obliterate the recovery. The cost of taking the country back into lockdown would be staggering.
This idea of more lockdowns, people just throw this out willy-nilly, forgetting the enormous human cost as well as the enormous economic cost. The country can't take that, and there's no reason for that.
Biden's lockdowns would also lead to more health crises. Even with a limited temporary lockdown, things were bad. And imagine if it had continued through most of the year. Last month, the Washington Post reported that suspected overdoses nationally jumped 18% in March, 29% in April, and 42% in May. And lockdowns around the world are leading to a resurgence of things like tuberculosis, HIV, and malaria. The New York Times reporting that a three-month lockdown across different parts of the world and a gradual return to normal over 10 months could result in an additional 6.3 million cases of TB, 1.4 million deaths. In the worst-case scenario, deaths from malaria could double to 770,000 per year. Number six, Biden would use the pandemic to ram through far-left policies. And of course, the old saying, never let a crisis go to waste, would be Biden's pandemic motto.
And I truly think that if we do this right, we have an incredible opportunity to not just dig out of this crisis, but to fundamentally transform the country.
Well, it wouldn't be a country left. Of course, we all know what that means. Ramming through every socialist wish list item. Empty out the prisons, single-payer health care, government-paid child care, the Green New Deal, guaranteed basic income, and, of course, reparations. And while President Biden went about transforming our country, he'd, of course, get a free pass from the media. No antagonistic interviews with Axios, no aggressive questioning from Jim Acosta, just a lot of gauzy profiles about his vice president and how she's a first and she's also a global superstar. This laundry list of horribles should make all Americans think about voting for change, think twice about it, in November. Now, given the violence in the streets and the leftward turn of the Democrats, we know what Biden will bring isn't the type of hope and change that Obama promised 12 years ago. It would be far more radical. And now there's far more at stake. But they hope their lies and their misdirection will make you forget about the unparalleled prosperity that we enjoyed before the pandemic hit and what we're on a way to seeing again under President Trump. Would you rather go back to that normal or experience the new normal that Democrats are giving us a glimpse of in California and in New York and on the streets of Chicago and Baltimore? In Joe's new society, you'll be poorer, less safe, less free, and your kids will be less educated. And at that point, a virus will be the least of our problems. And that's the angle.
There is not a person alive who has experienced what a world without this darkness could be like. A world of free energy that was kept from us to force our dependency on their fossil fuel monopolies. Abolishment of income tax that was illegally imposed to pay back interest on loans taken from the cabal banking system. Released cures for our most deadly diseases. Unleashed space technologies to open frontiers we never dreamed possible. New technologies creating millions of jobs and yielding a global human renaissance the likes of which we have never seen. Fellow Americans and citizens of the world, now it is our turn to shine. Wherever we are, we will become the plan when we choose to reject what they called globalism. We recognize the words they use to bend us to their will, and we say no more. It's time to turn off the media, follow your instincts, trust yourself, and be the plan. May God bless America and the world.
May God bless
America.